From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? That's what we'll examine this hour in our monthly economic roundup. While certain sectors like high tech and certain regions like the Seacoast are often cited these days as obvious economic winners, we'll dig into how that came to be and who else might be in this group. And we'll look at the other side of the ledger, those who haven't made out as well in our current economy, and what policy changes might shine some economic light onto those darker places. And let's hear from you too. How do you see yourself or your own community in terms of this question? Who's coming out ahead and who's been left behind in today's economy? The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. Steve, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
You as well.
Also with us, Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, based in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and all of you, this is our theme, as I said, winners and losers in today's Granite State economy, how that's changed. But before we do get into that, I did want to ask you real quick, Russ, first off, some pretty major economic news this morning. Fears of higher U.S. interest rates sent stock markets down on Friday, and then this morning in European Asian markets. How come, Russ?
Well, I think that if the Fed were to raise interest rates, it would kind of shift money away from Wall Street towards fixed income bonds and certificates of deposit.
So stocks become less attractive
relative to other investment vehicles. And I think there is sort of this groundswell or sort of just below the surface here where the Fed is really interested in raising rates because borrowers are punished in this environment. We're talking about winners and losers. It's been a good environment for borrowers, but not a good environment for savers. Savers are punished, I meant to say, in this environment. So the Fed is also a little concerned about, is there a bubble on Wall Street? So there's a terrific amount of attention being paid to the Fed. And there's uncertainty because the U.S. economy isn't growing really, really fast. And the job growth last month's numbers were sort of mediocre, neither great nor poor. So there's a lot of interest in this and a lot of speculation. But the bottom line is, in terms of the stock market impact, it would shift resources and assets away from the stock market to other investment vehicles.
Well, and as you said, Russ, you know, recent economic numbers have been okay, you know, meh, as some people
right,
would say.
Right.
So why would the Fed kind of throw water on the party and when the party's not going that great anyway? I mean, it's going okay, but...
Well, I think that interest rates have been very, very low. And as I said, it is kind of the current interest rate environment is punishing savers and rewarding borrowers. And these low interest rates do help corporate America show good profit growth because their cost of borrowing is
right,
very low. So I think the Fed is a little bit concerned maybe about a bubble on Wall Street and a little bit concerned that we've taken enough out of savers to encourage the economy to grow. It's time to reward. And lastly, they want some room to maneuver in case the economy does head south again.
I see. Yeah. Jeff, what do you think?
I was going to say that there are people who say that the low interest rates we've had for many, many years now has contributed to this boom on Wall Street that we've seen has been going on for just as long. And because it's just basically – in a way, subsidizing Wall Street, because that's the place where you can get some kind of returns on your investment. As Russ was saying, for savers in bonds or just in a savings account, you basically get nothing. So there are people who say, well, you know, this is almost it's almost an artificial boom in a lot of ways. There's reasons to be investing in corporations and all that, but in a lot of ways, it's because of such low interest rates, it's really the only place in many cases to go, and that it also has included real estate until relatively recently, which had been, you know, more of a longer term investment, but it has been Wall Street for a long time.
Russ?
Yeah, Jeff. In short, what it's saying is it's kind of distorting investment
yes,
decisions that both corporate America and individuals are making to have interest rates this low in an attempt to spur economic growth. It's distorting conventional market forces in a way that can be a little dangerous if it goes too long, too deep.
Did you want to jump in,
just,
Steve, on that?
You know, we're 10 years into an expansion period. We're getting on close to the longest expansion post-World War II. it's time for the business cycle to recycle. And so I think that's also what they're artificially keeping this going forward. Maybe it's time to retrench.
If you if you remember Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman, talking about irrational exuberance.
I do remember that. Well, I did want to ask you guys about that. But let's focus on the question of the hour this morning on our monthly economic roundup. Again, who are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy and why? Also, what policy prescriptions might change that equation of winners and losers a little bit? Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your own thoughts and personal experiences on that question. Who are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter as we talk about this issue. And Russ, I did want to turn to you first, but obviously hear from everybody. How do you frame this question? Is it by geography? Is it by occupation? Is it by age? Is it by education level? How do you even begin to sort out?
Well, it's really kind of all of those things. You can sort of cut this in many different ways in terms of winners and losers. Probably the biggest way is you look at the top 1% and their income growth here in New Hampshire since 2009 is over 30% versus the rest of us around 3% between 2009 and 2012. Right.
Wow.
Top 1% versus the other 99%. So I think that's the biggest dichotomy that I think underlies a lot of the angst that people feel in this economy, because the numbers are pretty good. Unemployment rates in New Hampshire, very low, nationally low. Job growth, pretty good. Economic growth, pretty good. People feeling poorly. Another way to look at it, other than income, is geography, as you mentioned, Laura. Southern New Hampshire, Hillsborough and Rockingham County doing very well. Income growth somewhere overall over the long period, around 30%. It's 5 to 15% in, say, Belknap, Carroll, Coos County. So geography is another way to kind of dichotomize what's been going on. And then you look at corporate America, Wall Street versus Main Street. Wall Street's doing great. Corporate profits up over 70%. As we said, personal income, Main Street, small businesses, not doing so well. So there's a lot of different ways to slice it. But I think the bottom line is that the winners in this economic recovery that Steve alluded to being 10 years long, a fairly narrow spectrum of society and the economy. The losers, much broader. And that's getting translated, I think, into the political discussions that we hear so much.
Interesting.
About.
So when you look at the big numbers, it looks pretty good. But when you dig into it by, you know, geography, people, income levels, and so forth, it's not as widespread as it looks
it's
on the
It's very
surface.
Narrow,
well,
I think.
There's another way to think about it. The median household income has not recovered to the recession. That means that that bottom half of the population is still worse off than it was prior to the recession.
Wow.
Whereas, you know, average income has gone up, to Russ's point. So,
what do you think is the best way to look at this, Steve, you know, in terms of winners and losers? I mean, do you do it by sector? Do you do it by geography? How
well,
do you?
I think right now the big story in New Hampshire and the diversity is cities and non-cities. If you look at the job growth post the recession, it's largely been in three areas: Portsmouth, Dover, and Manchester. Nashua is still struggling to recover, and the rest of the state, I would argue, is still in a recession. So we're, you know, if we do get to this conversation about policies, those different areas are going to require some very different approaches, assuming they want to continue on with economic growth.
So country mice and city mice is another way
to look
at
that's
it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
So how else do you look at it, Jeff?
Well, Steve raises a good point about this, because really, it's not looking at the big picture. You know, you look at the numbers overall, you know, as Russ was giving, you know, you have to look at them more deeply, because it is a matter of not just the sector, but within the sector, what's going on, you know, because there are let's say in the real estate industry, in real estate, you know, people who own homes right now are doing pretty well. I mean, it's like inventory is very low. Prices have been going up, really dramatically now for several months, if not more than several months, a couple of years. And but then you can look at people who want to just rent a home, rent an apartment. Those prices are skyrocketing. It's really difficult to find a place.
Takes a big bite out of their income.
Yeah, it takes a big bite out of their income, and there are very few available. You know, vacancy rates are extremely high, and it's real. I mean, very low. I mean, and uh, it, it's it's you know, so you look at each sector, at each industry, and there are winners and losers within each of them, each one. And then you look at, like you say, geographically, you talk about New Hampshire, people – you know, when we had the primary going, you know, when it was the presidential primary, and the candidates say, well, New Hampshire's doing great, doing great. Well, as Steve said, parts of New Hampshire are doing great. Others aren't. And there are parts of New Hampshire that have not been doing great for a long time, you know, in the North Country in particular. It's hard to just kind of paint with a broad brush about what the economy is like.
Go ahead, Russ.
You know, it's a good point. One of the news articles that I came across in the last week or so is that EFI, which is a high-tech printing firm in Meredith, about 350 employees, as I recall, is moving from Meredith to Londonderry because of labor availability. So we're seeing kind of New Hampshire is on a tilt, and a lot of things are slipping to southern New Hampshire and moving into southern New Hampshire. But Northern New Hampshire, we've talked about, is kind of losing it. And I think that EFI is a decision. It's great that they're staying in New Hampshire, but it's another example of how New Hampshire is on a tilt and a lot of stuff is slipping.
They're also adding jobs when they move to Londonderry.
They're not just
taking the jobs from Meredith. They're adding jobs. But as I saw in the local paper up in Laconia, a lot of those people aren't going to be moving from the Meredith to Londonderry.
I suspect a lot of them will be commuting.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I've got a friend in the North Country who was laid off, and a big layoff, and is now commuting from way up north to Lincoln. So it's about an hour and 15 minutes, you know, day by day.
Right.
And happy to have a job, but I-93, you know, maybe getting crowded with people who are making these long commutes. So you guys are dividing this up by, you know, income level and geography and sector by sector and so forth. There's a bunch of ways that we could tackle this, but since we're talking about geography, let's talk about it a little bit more. And Steve, to you first. I mean, we've done so many programs about this North-South divide, why the South keeps booming, why the North keeps falling behind. I mean, it's not for lack of attention. I just wonder, we've been talking about this for 25 years.
Right, and I think we're going to be talking about it for another 10. That nationally, rural parts of the country are continuing to shrink.
So it's not just New Hampshire.
No, it's not just New Hampshire at all. And, you know, we've gone from the resource being a natural resource to the resource being dense population and engagement and human capital. And so economic activity has moved away from rural areas, and so have jobs. And now we're still seeing rural America right-sizing itself, trying to find out what the right balance of population and place is. And it's a very difficult transition, and it's still going on.
You know, there's been so much attention, Steve. There's been, you know, this commission and that commission and this effort and that grant. And I mean, there has been efforts here in New Hampshire to help the North Country. I just wonder why it's not enough.
Well, to a certain extent, you cannot create an economy where there's no resource to extract any longer. I mean, you think about, you know, the wood industry was a huge part of the North Country, and what that resource is still an amazing resource, but it supports a much smaller population. Amenity communities don't support the big manufacturing jobs, and so they're still trying to transition to this new world.
Wow, it's been a long transition, Russ.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a cushion in the North Country, although a lot of people feel it's not a great one, which is tourism, and that is holding up pretty well. But I recall that one of my first assignments when I moved back to New Hampshire in 1976 was an economic development strategy for the city of Berlin, and that was 40 years ago. I could do that study again today, and I think that we're bucking very powerful market forces is the bottom line in northern New Hampshire. It's still probably worth effort. I don't think we should give up the ghost, but I think at the same time we have to have realistic expectations, which is that in today's economy, as Steve pointed out, the resource is people, particularly skilled workers. That is the resource. If you look at, there was a group that ranked the states by the strength of their economy. New Hampshire ranked pretty well. I think we were seventh nationally. And they looked at employment growth, unemployment rates, income, stuff like that, which is pretty good. And the reason for that is we do have a diverse economic base with high tech, strong growth, as Steve pointed out, in Manchester, the seacoast, and at least recently, until recently, Hanover, Lebanon. So I think that the diversity helps us as a state as a whole, but we have to be realistic about what we can achieve in the North Country.
Yeah, I also think one of the things that comes into play in terms of the North Country in particular, and also the other rural areas in New Hampshire, is infrastructure. And I'm not just talking about highways and roads and bridges, but I'm also talking about technology, you know, broadband. And without, you know, I know I've written about many times about the lack of available of broadband in the North Country. That really, in this day and age, it's just a handicap. And that's something that's been discussed about trying to push it, getting it, making it available. But that's also why you've seen this exodus of people out of there, because without that kind of infrastructure, you can't attract people to stay and have that human capital to attract the employers.
Okay, so that's the next question I wanted to ask you, Steve. Again, not just the North Country, but this focus that you've been making on sort of urban areas and the vitality there versus New Hampshire's rural areas. How much do policy choices, either at the state or the local level, encourage those winning aspects, you know, the entrepreneurs, the workers, the vital sectors? How much do policy choices really make a difference when it comes to sparking these rural areas, not just in the North Country?
Right. So policies can affect schools at the state level. How you spend money, how you allocate resources across communities can fundamentally shift the education system. You know, take Manchester as an example. You could craft a formula to distribute resources to Manchester because it's the gem, you know, of the state, and you want it to have the top, you know, K through 12 education system in the Northeast. Instead, we are trying to protect North Country schools from, you know, declines in enrollment and expenditures. That's just one aspect. There's tax policy. You could craft some tax structure that would support entrepreneurs differently than legacy organizations. You could tax capital differently for firms of less than 10. I mean, you could do lots of things to encourage different types of economic activity. The question is, which one's the right one, and how do you approach it? If you ask the business community right now what the goal is, it's probably to maintain what we have. And that is a very different policy construct than trying to encourage small businesses or trying to get businesses to move to New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I think, too, Steve, you might throw transportation policy into the mix as well. A tremendous amount of money that we're investing into Interstate 93 from the Massachusetts border to Manchester. It's a huge amount. I don't know, $250 million, $500 million. It's a big number. And that dwarfs anything that we've done in the North Country, that alone. The discussion about rail is an important discussion in terms of economic policy and how fast we grow. I think the policy is different depending where you are in New Hampshire. In the South, we're trying to accommodate maybe growth, and in the North, we're trying to encourage it. So,
are we encouraging it, though? It sounds like all those investments are focused, you know, hooks at South.
Yeah, it's a tough game to play. I think by and large, what we hoped would happen in the North Country has at least so far been not successful across the board.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, one of the suggestions, speaking of transportation, has been the construction of a east-west highway that would go basically from Portland, Maine, to Montreal, and it would be, you know, basically an interstate. And there's really been no interest. It's been talked about for decades, and there's really been no interest to do it. Actually, the last people who brought it up was a private contractor who said he would build it as a private, you know, business. But that didn't get off the ground.
Winners versus losers in today's New Hampshire economy. More on that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a roundup of New Hampshire's economic news, our monthly economic roundup. This month, we're focusing on this question: who are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? We'd love your thoughts on that. How does your town stack up in terms of this question, winners or losers? How about your own situation? How do you feel? Have you been a part of the Granite State's economic success? Or do you feel like you've been left behind in today's economy? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Russ Tebow's here, president of Applied Economic Research based in Laconia. Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. And Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And all of you, you know, we were talking earlier about how you even begin to divide up this question. Is it by sector? Is it by region? Is it by income level? Russ Tebow, what about by age? Can we figure out who's a winner and loser in today's economy by looking at how old someone is?
Yeah, actually, there is a dichotomy between young people who have really taken a hit in terms of real income growth after factoring in inflation versus kind of the older segment, the 55 to 65 and even 65 and over, who have actually shown a little bit of income growth. And I think what it's saying is this economy is rewarding experience. And millennials are trying to build their briefcase, trying to build a resume of experience, and it's a struggle for them. And
that's always been the case, though, hasn't it, Russ? I mean,
I think there were more opportunities when I was in that age category of, say, 20 to 30 years old than there are today for young people. It was easy for most of me, for me and most of my peers, to land a pretty good job. It's very been very difficult for my kids to do that. And so I think that we're seeing, if you look at income by age, millennials are suffering. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that so are their parents because they're moving back home. Maybe you're helping to pay for the rent or buy a car for them. So it's really that dichotomy is very important, I think, right across the board, it, certainly for the millennials themselves and also for their parents.
Steve, you've done a lot of work looking at New Hampshire's demographics. I wonder if you agree with Russ's interpretation that you can put old versus young in this winner versus loser category.
I think you can. I think the millennials are coming of their age, at least in terms of their employment, in a period where there's been no job growth, where there's been a great recession, where the opportunities have been less for a young person. And so, yeah, absolutely. The 45-year-old who had a job in the recession maybe weathered that storm, and the 19 or 21-year-old coming out of college during that time period still struggling to figure out what their economic future is going to look like.
Jeff, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, and that also explains a lot of what Steve was talking about before about the idea of this urban versus rural, because a lot of those younger people are finding their opportunities because there are more opportunities in cities. And that's one of the reasons why places like Boston, New York, Seattle, you know, all these cities where there are many more opportunities for younger people, that's where they're congregating. That's where they're moving to, and that's why states like New Hampshire are losing. We're, you know, New Hampshire's a loser in that sense too, because we're getting older and older as we lose our younger population to these other places.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, speaking of the cities being vibrant, and Steve mentioned that, and you just mentioned that, Jeff, I looked at the Inc. magazine list of the 5,000 fastest growing companies, 23 in New Hampshire, including a lot in what are called IT services and IT marketing. And a lot of these companies were based in Portsmouth, with a couple in Bedford, actually, and Manchester and Nashua. I think there was one in Exeter. It was real interesting to me to look at this list of where these fastest growing companies are in New Hampshire. Steve Norton, any surprises there? You know, Portsmouth, Bedford, Manchester, Nashua.
No, that's
nothing in Concord, by the way,
nothing,
our hometown.
No, and you know, that's pretty consistent with all the data that shows those communities are where the job growth is happening. And whether it's the millennials or not, or whether it's just simply the nature of where millennials are right now, I think it's quite possible that we'll see, again, some suburbanization occurring as the millennials age and start families and want to live in places other than cities, but maybe not at the rate it was in the past. And then so we see it concentrated in the cities now. We may get a little suburban growth in 5 or 10 years.
Well, and especially Portsmouth, I was really struck by.
Portsmouth is one part of it. It's really Dover that's really driving that economic activity right
now. So what's the secret?
So the secret is amenities and workforce and a core set of industries which can build out around it. So you take Manchester and what's happened with Dyne. You're seeing a little bit of an ecology of tech there. You've seen the same sort of marketing Boston feel in Portsmouth, and in Dover, it's a lot of aerospace stuff with Albany International and other firms like that coming together. So amenities, industry, and people.
And also, it's a big factor on this for the seacoast is Pease de Trapo. The redevelopment of Pease has added 10,000 jobs or something like that in these huge companies. It's been very, very successful, and when success breeds success. I mean, when you have, as you said, like you have a company like Dine in Manchester. People want to be, you know, their spinoffs. There are some Dine employees have left and started their own companies and stayed in Manchester. This is what happens, and the same thing has happened in Portsmouth, Dover, and it happens on a much larger scale. And you know, as I said, in these other big cities like Boston, you know, Boston's a perfect example.
Okay, so it's interesting you mentioned P's. That again gets to a policy choice,
absolutely.
And the federal government made a policy choice, you know, almost 30 years ago, I think now, at least 25 years ago, to close that base down. It was a lot of angst. There was a lot of hair pulling. This is going to be terrible. But lo and behold, it closed, and there were policy choices made
by the state of New Hampshire,
Jeff, that we're going to do a public-private partnership, and lo and behold, you know, it's moving.
It's been like a great success story, even to this day, whenever any place is faced with a base closure, they go to talk to the people at Pease. How did you do it? and it's true, and it's really remarkable how successful it's been.
Yeah, what's the secret to this Portsmouth-Dover magnetism, Russ?
I think it's a lot of the right assets are in place. Good transportation links to metropolitan Boston. Good transportation links to the rest of to Maine, north, south, and east, west. Good
so
transportation
bus, rail,
availability
I-95,
of sites.
Yeah.
Right when Pease was chosen as a SAC base because it's very flat, buildable land. And the runway there is 10,000 feet long. I've sat at the end of it. You can almost see the curvature of the earth. The runway is so long. And so it's very readily developable. It's in an area that has a lot of attractiveness in terms of amenities, on a small scale, the same kind of amenities you see in larger cities. Good restaurants, entertainment sector, University of New Hampshire right on the doorstep. So a lot of nice assets came together to develop at Pease what is a really diverse mix of firms and employment, ranging from hotel and lodging, a brewery, a lot of technology. So it's really been a big success story. And it does highlight the significance of public and private partnership working together.
And choices that are made, yeah.
I was going to say, it's interesting when Russ is mentioning the airport because at Pease, because that is an amazing landing strip there. It's just amazing. But they've never been able to really develop the kind of airport they've been trying to since the beginning. It was going to be the airport was going to be the centerpiece of
right.
Pease.
Over the past 20 years, yeah. Various airlines have come in and said we're going to do this, and it never seems to fly apart.
It's because of that location. They are so close to Boston. They're close to Portland, and close to Manchester, which has been successful. It's had its problems lately. That's actually, you're talking about winners and losers in transportation. Manchester has not been a big winner recently. And so Pease is just sitting there, the airport there, which is, you think it would be a great spot, but it's not because of that location.
Right.
So, but they're not struggling for it.
Absolutely not. They're just not. They never were able to attract, you know, a big airline like a Southwest or a JetBlue,
right.
or to have that kind of airline service because they're so the airlines are so close to each other. The airports are so close to where Pease is that it really hasn't been able to do it.
Yeah, it's a donut with kind of a honey dip donut where there's a hole in the middle rather than a jelly donut where the jelly's in the middle. And Pease is in the middle in terms of the transportation, but there's a dichotomy. Very successful in terms of job
Absolutely.
Creation and real estate. And they made a lot of good decisions. They decided, no, we're not going to let this housing. There were a lot of housing units on the base. They cleared them and said, this is going to be a job center, not a housing center. And so there were a lot of good decisions. The state deciding to step in big time and lend money to the effort. The feds kind of giving a green light to the redevelopment in fairly broad terms. So it struggled initially, but then caught hold great.
All right. Well, as we talk about winners and losers in today's New Hampshire economy, definitely the seacoast, Portsmouth especially, Dover, one of the winners. We talked earlier about some of the rural areas as some of the losers in today's economy. You can join us, too. We'd love your thoughts and questions, including your own personal experiences. How do you feel you stack up in terms of this question, winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. The number 1-800-892-6477. Well, Jeff, I wanted to ask you about this in terms of winners and losers. Healthcare is often cited as a winning sector of our economy here in the Granite State, but late last week, there was an announcement about layoffs at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Big layoffs. you know, maybe up to 5% of the staff, although it's still unclear. You first, Jeff, but Steve, I want to hear from you too. How indicative is this of problems in the healthcare sector broadly here in New Hampshire, and how much is this just specific problems at DHMC?
I think looking at it from what I understand about the situation right now, this is a first of all, Dartmouth Hitchcock is by far one of the most the biggest employers in the state.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
It's yeah, everywhere, and it's almost 10,000 employees. I think really at this point, what you can say is that a lot of this is unique to Dartmouth. These problems, there are certain internal things they decided on, some kind of billing system that hasn't worked out, that's hit them with a big loss. They've had some other decisions that were recently made. That have not panned out, and but it is also reflective of what's going on in the healthcare industry, especially in this part of the country. There's so much consolidation going on. There's a lot of alliances by smaller hospitals, and we've seen it recently in Dover with Wentworth Douglas. I've become getting into an alliance with Mass General. And Lahey Clinic has been making alliances. These are two big Massachusetts medical centers. And what Dartmouth is, because it is the big kahuna up here, it has to compete with Mass General and Lahey Clinic.
Sure.
And apparently they have not been they've tried, but they have not really made as much of a successful effort as, let's say, Mass General has done or Lahey Clinic. And they've had to basically retrench at this point and just kind of regroup and see what's going on.
Steve, a couple years ago you did a real interesting report about the importance of healthcare in terms of New Hampshire regions and the big role hospitals play in different regions. What's your take on this? You know, a problem, a big problem in healthcare in general, or more specific to this one institution?
Well, I think there, if you look back in the 90s and the 2000s, operating expenses were going up, you know, 8% per year, 10% per year. That means revenue was going up that fast because they were, you know, they weren't in the red, they were in the black as an industry. And market forces have really changed, and now you're seeing 2% increase in expenses, and it's really slowed down across the board. Add on top of that the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the incentives to create accountable care organizations, which are in essence, you know, think of a wheel with spokes going out and consolidated collaborations across multiple different providers. And unfortunately, Dartmouth is far away from the population centers. You think about what Mass General is, they are at the center of a big population center, and they are reaching out to try and create, you know, alliances and draw those patients for their tertiary and quaternary care down into Boston. And so I think you can see in Dartmouth's efforts to align with CMC and now talk of aligning with Elliott means they're trying. But they may be behind the eight ball a bit.
Well, and when this news came out, Steve, a lot of officials said, hey, you know, obviously this is concerning, but this is a vital sector in New Hampshire, and there's a lot of other healthcare organizations that would be only too happy to have this very skilled workforce. So lots of hope that these folks will get jobs pretty quickly. Do you think that that's accurate?
Well, we'll see. Everyone says that we have a workforce shortage, and I think we do have workforce shortage. It's not clear to me necessarily that anything other than nurses. But in any event, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Just nurses. Certainly everyone's looking for nurses in the southern part of the state, and there will be opportunities there. But, you know, the industry itself is in flux, so we won't know for a while whether we're going to.
The healthcare industry, you know. Yeah, which is worth probably a look for a whole program because
sure.
Yep. There's a lot going on. You're absolutely
well,
right.
Actually,
Jeff, real quick, and then we'll go to our callers.
One of the things that Dartmouth Hitchcock did cite as one of these costs that were just extreme was this need to pay for traveling nurses, and that's really been you know, because they can't find people who will work to fill those jobs, so they have to pay, you know, a premium to get people who just stay for, you know, temporary nurses, and so apparently, you know, there is a great need for, you know, skilled nurses in New Hampshire.
All right, we've got some listeners who want to jump in on this question that we're looking at today on our monthly economic roundup. The question again, who are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? How is this shifting? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Lynn in Portsmouth. Hi, Lynn. We were just talking about your region earlier as a winner in today's economy. What do you think?
Hi, Laura. I'm calling because I've lived in Portsmouth now for 31 years, and when I moved to Portsmouth, it was very much a blue-collar town. Downtown, there were a lot of empty stores. We bought our house in 1996. Today, our house is worth more than three times what we paid for it. The cost of housing is so expensive that people who have lived here for generations can't afford to buy in Portsmouth. We wouldn't be able to afford to buy in Portsmouth if we were buying today. So a lot of Portsmouth has been priced out of the people who've been there forever, the fishermen, the iron workers. Those people can't afford to live in Portsmouth today.
So that's the downside of the boom that you've seen in Portsmouth, Lynn, is that it's super expensive to live there for lots of people.
Yes, and there have been a lot of changes. People buying houses, tearing them down, building 6,000
right.
square foot McMansions that don't fit in the neighborhood.
Thank you. Yeah, Lynn, thank you for calling in. What do you think? In fact, Russ, the BIA just last week did a forum on housing costs in New Hampshire.
Right, and the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority's their conference is going to look at the relationship between housing and economic development, and I think that's really the core of Lynn's comments here. I think that there's no question that Portsmouth, if you're looking for affordable housing, that's the downside of the Seacoast economy right now, and maybe the downside of a lot of the booming areas in New Hampshire. However, interest rates have dropped, and I looked at the comparison, and this goes back to something that Jeff said. I looked at the comparison between the change in monthly rent and the change if you bought a house in 2009 and financed it versus buying one today. Home prices are still down a little bit, and interest rates are down a lot, so that rental costs in New Hampshire are up about 15% during that time frame. Ownership costs are down 37%. That's not to dispute what Lynn is saying, but overall, this has favored home ownership. I think in the Seacoast area, we're seeing a movement away from Portsmouth towards Dover, Rochester, up the Spalding Turnpike for more affordable housing.
So some spreading.
It is, yeah.
That might be part of Dover's success, Steve.
Yeah, agreed, yep.
Here's an email from Tom. Thank you for the call, Lynn, by the way. Tom says, I would like to propose one loser in our state's economy that is often not discussed. That loser, Tom says, may be we, the taxpayers, as we've entered a period of low investment returns and low interest rates. The public pension obligations continue to expand dramatically for the public sector. New Hampshire has one of the 10 worst unfunded pension systems in the country, according to Bloomberg. Tom says, if higher taxes for all of us are on the horizon, what might this imply for our state's economy? This is a big question, gentlemen. We're heading into a break. So, Tom, we'll tackle it after the break. One of the issues, though, Steve, I know you've been looking at is, you know, state budgets, state financing, the issue of these outstanding obligations. So, Tom, we'll tackle that in just a moment. And we'll take more of your calls, too. So if you're on the line, stay there. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly roundup of economic news with Jeff Feingold, Steve Norton, and Russ Thibault. This month, we're focusing on one question. Who are the winners and losers in today's Granite State economy? Join us with your thoughts on that question. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And guys, before we go back to the phones, Steve, I wanted to get your take on Tom's email. He said, what about the unfunded public pensions? Are we going to have to see higher taxes to make up for that lack of funding? And, you know, what does this imply for the state's economy? I wonder what you think.
Well, I think in the short term, we might have actually some revenue beyond expectations.
Budget surplus,
that's right. So I think the question of tax probably not going to come up in this next budget session, but more a question of what to do with those resources that are there. And I think before we get to the pension piece, we're going to get to the healthcare retiree benefit and whether we are funding that appropriately. The pension is a big nut to crack, but this one is an obligation that the state is going to have to take up in the next few years.
So, and the state, I know, and you've been talking to people, is looking at, you know, what to do with a surplus, which still what we've seen in recent years sounds like a funny question to ask. But do you think state policymakers, Steve, are going to take some of those surplus monies and address the health care of retirees and the pensions?
No, I think a lot will depend on who's elected in November, because, of course, the different parties have different agendas. And I think that there's the if the Republicans are in control, then we're going to be having a conversation like we've had for the last few years, which is, do we lower business taxes and use some of that surplus to give it to businesses and to encourage economic development in that way? On the other side of the coin, we're hearing conversations about expansions in childcare subsidies, which might help support women to stay in the workforce. So a lot of it's going to depend who's in control.
Yeah, go ahead, Russ. You want to jump in on that pension question that Tom asks and concern about taxes?
Yes, I think part of the pension problem is that the rates of return are artificially low because of the interest rate policies that the Fed has in place.
Because interest rates are so low.
Yeah, so there is hope that as interest rates rise and get to more normal levels, the rates of return for the investments of the pension fund today that will pay future benefits, those rates of return will go up and solve at least part of this problem. Maybe
That's
not all of it.
But aren't a lot of these pension funds invested in the stock market?
But not exclusively. And so there are limits on how much is prudent to put into the stock market. There may even be limits on how much is legal.
Do you want to jump in real quick,
Jeff? I just want to say that it's interesting because this is a major issue that really I haven't heard come up in the current gubernatorial campaigns at
right.
all.
Right. Actually, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't heard anybody talk about this.
And, you know, maybe it's time for it to come up as an issue.
Well, thank you again, Tom, for raising it here on the Econ Roundup. We appreciate it. You can send us an email like Tom did, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Reed's in Wolfboro. Hi, Reed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey. My comment is that, and question is, that the state has been extremely slow or non-existent in building transit. And I hear that as the common denominator. We're bemoaning the struggles of the North Country. Dartmouth-Hitchcock can barely draw from its own state. Pease is underutilized. And we're very unwelcoming to youth. Youth don't want to own cars. It would be the smartest thing in the world to build up east-west transit for both trains and north-south and shuttles and buses. I live in Wolfboro. I can't get to Dover.
Yeah, Wolfboro's a tough spot. It's lovely, but yeah.
And the thing is, there are many, many, many. I mean, everything from including the Lakes region north is being left out of this until we, you know, man up and say, okay, we just need to make the state transit smart.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for calling in. And, boy, speaking of the Lakes region, Russ, anybody who's been stuck on that road going into Meredith on a weekend, oh, my goodness.
Or even going into Laconia.
I think partly it's, you know, an accident of geography. You have those beautiful lakes, and you just you can't, you know, build a giant bridge over Lake Winnipesaukee. But
that's right.
What do you think about Reed's criticism?
Well, I think she's got a good point, and I think that there is a good transit system, for example, in the Upper Valley in Hanover, Lebanon, and it works very well. And it's basically free to ride on. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities that could encourage more economic growth, more diversity of economic growth with a transit system in place. The problem, the challenge we have is once you get out of metropolitan areas, as Steve has pointed out, the population density is so low that it's very difficult to viably support a transit, public transit system.
But I think that transit system in the Upper Valley is subsidized by the major employers like Dartmouth, Hypertherm, and others because they see the need to have their employees have some kind of transit. But we don't see it in many other places in the state. Actually, in Claremont, just recently, they had to shut down their transit system, their bus system, because they had lack of funding. They didn't have the money to do it.
And wow. Well, here's an email from Peggy who says, can you ask about the potential impact of commuter rail in the south of New Hampshire to Manchester might have? So there's another transit question. This has come up, unlike the pension fund question. Jeff, this has come up in our state races.
Yes, it has. And
what's the transit system of New Hampshire's future?
Yes, and there have been several of the candidates. The Democrats have been supportive of this, but Republicans have been much more skeptical. And this is an example of where a public policy decision is going to pick winners and losers because, you know, there's been a lot of pressure in the southern part of the state to build this thing, to go from Boston to at least Nashua, if not Manchester, north to Concord. But, you know, that would leave out so much more of the state, even though these people, these businesses in particular down in that area would love to see a rail system.
Well, thanks for the email, Peggy. And again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, winners and losers in today's New Hampshire economy. To Antrim next, Ken is on the line. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
I worked 4 years for the same company transporting foster kids to and from appointments and visits. And I've gotten great reviews. And I've asked, hey, how about a raise? I've been here for a while. And they say, we just don't got the money. We can't. And you know, they've given me like a bonus. And they try to give me some, you know, really good jobs. But it's just, you know, I'm just making just into the double digits. It's not like I'm making, you know, pulling down big money here.
Yeah.
And it's just really sad to see, because a lot of my friends who are going to, in the same field are going down to Massachusetts where they can make 50% more doing the same thing.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for calling. And I did want to talk about public versus private sector. I mean, is that another way to slice up this question of winners versus losers? Here's Ken doing important work, Russ, you know, I mean, helping foster kids get to where they need to go. What are your thoughts on that divide, if there is one?
Well, it speaks to this big issue of relative affluence, relative job growth, relative wage growth. And I think that if you look at it, if Ken were probably an information systems analyst, he'd have a very easy time getting a job. If he was worked with networking, he'd have a very easy time getting a raise. So the skilled dichotomy is what I think really Ken is really speaking to in the state. And the lack of wage growth in the lower skilled occupations is really striking and creates winners and losers.
Steve, what do you think? Public sector versus private sector? I mean, the public sector for a long time was thought of as good jobs, maybe not high paying, but good benefits and so forth.
If you look at the jobs, you've seen a decline in public sector jobs.
Yes.
Post the Great Recession. And really the only place you're seeing growth is in the private sector. And I think that's partially downsizing of rural New Hampshire. But I also think there's been funding difficulties for the last, you know, 10 years. Remember, this last budget was the first time that we actually exceeded expectations. And so we'll see now, as in the private sector, we're seeing wage increases. Will we see it in the public sector as well because we've seen additional revenues? Don't know.
Well, and declining school-age populations means fewer teachers. That's a big part of the public
actually,
sector workforce.
It is. Though, strangely enough, it doesn't look like we're seeing as big a decline in teachers as we are in enrollment, which makes sense because the system is somewhat sticky. If you go from a class of, you know, 20 to 16, you still need a teacher.
Right. Russ, do you want to jump in? Or
I was just going to reiterate what Steve said. A lot of it has to do with local government scaling back, particularly in terms of education.
Well, and speaking of public sector workers like Ken, Jeff, there's been a lot of concern, too, that as New Hampshire starts to fund this opioid crisis and substance, we need more treatment, we need more prevention, we need substance abuse workers. There's been a lot of concern about where those people are going to come from.
Exactly. That's a perfect example of you know, how we don't have the kind of workforce that we necessarily need to fill our needs in many cases. You know, when, like you talk about, you know, skilled workers in manufacturing or whatever, it's just not, they're not available. But, you know, there are other people who have, you know, there's plenty of people who are available to do retail work or whatever.
Well, thanks for the question, and good luck to you, by the way. The phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, as we look at this question again of winners and losers, Jeff, I'll start with you. The tech sector is often cited as a shining star, big winner in the New Hampshire economy. Just first off, Jeff, when we say tech, what do we mean, really? It's a pretty broad term.
Well, yeah, it's a very broad term, and it's really interesting because there's recently the executive director of the New Hampshire High Tech Council wrote an article that appeared in our paper about, you know, this definition of tech, and it's not just, you know, software and, you know, networking and all this, but it's like
people working at Google.
It's tech is covers so many other areas.
Sure.
You know, there's tech workers within companies that maybe you wouldn't consider tech. So the industry is, it's kind of almost like an abstract term in a way. But for the most part, let's just talk about those companies. Like we're talking about Dyn, we're talking about Albany International. I would consider Texas. They're building these high tech jet engines and all these things. Hypertherm in the Upper Valley is, you know, these high tech cutting tools. But you know, it when you look at that, New Hampshire has been very successful in in generating not just the jobs but also the startups, the entrepreneurs. You know, Dyne was a perfect example of a startup. It's just a couple of kids from Manchester who started this thing, and it's been very, very successful. Hypertherm also was a New Hampshire startup. There's been these companies started up around the Dartmouth College, where they've been extremely vibrant tech community there. Portsmouth as well. Nashua is a classic, and you know this is what you know this is basically the core of what the economic development people in New Hampshire like to point to as a sign of the New Hampshire's vibrant economy.
Well, and I like what you said, though. You can't really define a tech sector anymore, Russ. I mean, I'm thinking about NHPR. We've got 40, 50 people working here. A couple of them are our sort of tech team. I mean, is NHPR in the tech sector? No, not really. But we do have, you know, a lot of technology here and a couple of folks who are dedicated to that technology. So you can't really say that it's a sector, right?
You're right. There is an attempt to define it, and it's based on occupations rather than industry.
I see.
Okay.
That so makes more sense.
The concentration so that your, for example, your programmers here at NHPR would be considered tech. So it's defined by occupation rather than by industry. And if you go by that way, we're about the same ratio as national, somewhere around 10-12% of New Hampshire's workforce or jobs are tech jobs, irrespective of what industry they're in.
Well, and Steve Norton, a lot of people at the top levels of business leadership in this state have said, look, all manufacturing these days is tech, really, right. You know. And there's been a lot of angst, Steve, about not being able to find the right workers. I think the last time we all met, Jeff Feingold said that, you know, manufacturers have hundreds of good jobs open, but there's not enough skilled workers to find them. What's your perspective on that, Steve?
It's twofold. One, it's a market, so you could probably find a worker if you paid enough to bring someone here. So that's one answer to the question. But I think we have a structural problem, and that is, you know, when you look at the population age 25 to 55, it's declined by 5% since 2010. So we're losing a workforce. You know, they're aging out or they're moving elsewhere, and we're not seeing people move in. So I think probably in almost any industry now will face shortages in employment.
Healthcare industry, healthcare, the substance abuse counselors,
tech,
and so forth.
Yep.
I did see something recently, and I'll hear from anybody on this, that threw a little bit of water on this idea of there's no skilled workers. This is from 538, which is the sort of number crunchy folks who used to be with the New York Times. They say this skills mismatch theory is a favorite of corporate execs and the think tanks they found. But Russ Thibault, they say, based on scant evidence, little sign of an industry-wide shortage of skilled workers. I wonder what you think about that.
What they found is in contrast to what I hear on the street. I think that a lot of manufacturers in New Hampshire are complaining about the lack of skilled workers and are acting to kind of supplement the skilled workforce available. Hypertherm in the Upper Valley.
They have a big
New Hampshire Ball
program.
Bearing in the Lakes region and in Peterborough area. So they are. I think it's sincere. I think there really is a sincere concern among manufacturers in the state as to the availability of skilled workers.
Why not raise wages, Jeff? I mean, if there's such a shortage of skilled workers, why not boost manufacturing wages up a lot? 538 says manufacturing average hourly earnings are up 2.5%.
Yeah, well, as Russ was saying,
we really want people, you know, give them a big pay raise.
Absolutely. But really at the core is what Steve's saying is that I'm sure that wages have been going up in that specifically in, let's say, in the manufacturing sector. But it's really a matter of finding the people who can do the job. And as we said, you know, if we're losing that core, the number of possible employees, when it's not that's really what the problem is. It's not the problem of not having the skilled workers, not having people who have the skills. It's actually not having people who have skills. We don't have that. We have people in the state who can work, but they can't fill the need of these employers.
Well, that's what the community college system is supposed to do,
right?
Right.
But you know, let's take the stuff that 538 did. That's a national study.
Yeah. Sure.
Where population is increasing. New Hampshire's population is flat, and the working age population is actually declining. So, I'm not saying that there isn't some truth to the fact that there. The issue about the skills gap might be there in large, but I think it's more that we just don't have the people.
So here in New Hampshire,
that's right. It's a different place.
Picture. Yeah,
sure. The 538 article was basically about productivity and using automation and things like that, which is available in New Hampshire, obviously. But there's still I have talked to many, many manufacturers. They're not making this up that they can't find the people to fill the jobs.
That's the way I feel, too. I think it's real.
Well, and all of you did like to close out every month with you all, finding out what you're going to be looking at in the weeks ahead. Russ Thiebaud, you first. What economic numbers or trends are you going to be especially keeping a close eye on?
The Fed. And are they going to raise rates in September?
Right.
You said that last time.
Yeah, I know. We said that every month.
Well, it's still at the top of my list.
So when is that meeting?
It's coming up mid-month. So okay. It'll be soon.
Yeah. All right. Steve, how about you?
September 21st, that's when the Fed makes its decision. That's I think everyone's looking at that as the most important piece of information going forward.
Really? What other economic trends, ideas will you be watching in the next couple of weeks?
I'm trying to move away from month-to-month assessment of things, to be honest. That I think a lot of the hysteria creates a potential problem for us if we just look at what the Fed is going to do on September 21st.
Well, I know that I'm going to get a little more local here. I'm looking forward to seeing the numbers for August real estate sales. Residential real estate sales, because that's been something that's a real engine for the New Hampshire economy, and they've been this lack of inventory could be pretty troublesome at some point. Well, actually, it is right now, as we heard from the winners and losers in Portsmouth.
Well, we'll see you guys in a couple weeks. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Good
this is
here.
The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.